The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. We start with Shakespeare.
I wonder that you will still be talking, Signor Benedict. Nobody marks you.
What, my dear Lady Disdain? Are you yet living?
Is it possible Disdain should die while she hath such meat food to feed it as Signor Benedict? Courtesy itself must convert to disdain if you come in her presence.
Then is courtesy a turncoat. But it is certain I am loved of all ladies, only you excepted, and I would I could find in my heart that I had not a hard heart, for truly I love none.
A dear happiness to women. They would else have been troubled with a pernicious suitor. I thank God and my cold blood I am of your humour for that. I had rather hear my dog bark at a crow than a man swear he loves me.
God keep your ladyship still in that mind, so some gentleman or other shall scape a predestinate scratched face.
Scratching could not make it worse, and for such a face as yours were.
Well, you are a rare parrot, teacher.
A bird of my tongue is better than a beast of yours.
I would my horse had the speed of your tongue. But keep your way, in God's name, I have done.
You always end with a jade's trick.
So good. Part two of our discussion of great literary duos today on the history of literature. That was a great literary duo, Beatrice and Benedict, from Much Ado About Nothing, played by Kenneth Branagh, Emma Thompson. Will they make the list? We'll find out. In case you missed part one, Mike chose Hemingway and Fitzgerald for his first pick, the greatest literary duos of all time. I then chose Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin from the Patrick O'Brien novels. Mike chose Elena Ferrante's Elena and Lila from the Neapolitan novels. I chose Dr. Johnson and James Boswell. And now, part two of the literary draft. Literary duos with Mike, the president of the Literature Supporters Club. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code LITERATURE50 to get 50% off. That's code LITERATURE50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off.
All right. For my third pick, I went with Roth and Bellow.
Ooh, good one.
My experience of the two of them, who are probably, you know, the two American literary giants of the century, of last century. I read Roth first. I read Portnoy's Complaint first. And then I read Goodbye Columbus and Letting Go, of all things. So I was really a big Roth fan and just devouring everything by him. And then, I don't know, somebody mentioned that Sal Bellow was better. And I remember thinking, like, what? Who's Sal Bellow? And then I learned that you know, what Bellow had written, and I read Humboldt's Gift, which is, you know, an incredible book. And I've reread that book a couple of times, and I love that book. And then I was reading about their friendship, and this is an example of kind of a master and servant.
Yes.
Bellow was 18 years older, and, you know, by the time Roth published Goodbye Columbus, Bellow had published his fifth book, the book after Augie March, I think Henderson the Rankin. And they started up a literary friendship. They wrote about 30 letters to each other. And interestingly, in the letters, until probably the late 80s, so the majority of the letters, Bellow takes this position that he is the superior one. And that, but Roth's talent is unmistakable. So he writes stuff like this. He says to Philip Roth, "Your capacity for looking things in the face is not inferior to mine." a position that is almost—it's a little risky that Bellow took, because clearly Roth is, you know, getting a lot of accolades, a lot of press. And to Roth's credit, whether he ever, you know, felt bitterness, or Roth wrote back dutifully and said, you know, "Thank you for your time. You know, here's what I've been reading." They never really talked about writing, the process of writing, or, you know, literature. They kind of just talked about their lives. So in a sense, it was a literary friendship, but it was also, I feel like they were chums. They got to know each other and, because of their writing, but at the end, what they really enjoyed was each other's company.
And that's a great pick. And you know, one of the interesting things about it is Roth apparently was writing in a whole different style before he encountered the works of Sal Bellow. And Sal Bellow, and the way that he wrote, and the way that he wrote about the Jewish American experience, and it all kind of freed up Philip Roth to be the person that he eventually, the writer that he eventually became. And I think he always acknowledged that as kind of a debt, even if he at times probably equaled or was not inferior.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people, when they read the two of them, this is an example of kind of taking sides. You know, you have people, you have a fair number of people who like Roth better than Bellow, which I think is crazy now, but they do. They find Bellow to be more dated.
Right.
That something like Mr. Sandler's Planet is kind of laughable, the whole setup of that novel, or
right,
or that Henderson's Rain King is a little bit of a children's book. And
yeah, that's interesting. And I wonder, I've always preferred Bellow as well. And I wonder if part of that, the reason why Bellow is starting to feel dated to some people, it reminds me, I'm working on this new episode where I'm reading a lot of poets from the fall of the Roman Republic, that era. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look at someone like Virgil, who was always more respected and admired than Horace. And you read it, and it's almost like propaganda for the state. You kind of, the concerns in it are a little dated, you know, how Rome was founded and what it means to be a Roman and all of these things. It doesn't really matter anymore now that we've moved on from that historical period. But someone like Horace, who was writing about, you know, personal relationships and friendship and love, and you can read that, and if the translation is fresh and the language is fresh, it feels like the concerns are still the concerns we have today. And in some ways, it seems like that's a parallel with Roth and Bello. I think of Bello as having been more of a prize winner and more admired, maybe because he was taking on the Cold War and the latest, you know, intellectual arguments and the themes, you know, big, broad social themes, which was great for its time, especially. But sometimes you read it and you think, well, you know, this is no longer the concern that animates us. And then you read Philip Roth's book and it might be a little more local, a little more internal, a little more personal, usually about one of his ex-wives who's, yeah, it's usually sometimes a little bit unpalatable. I find him to be somewhat misogynistic at times, but in any case, it would be something that you wouldn't need to be in the middle of the Cold War in order to appreciate.
Yeah.
Okay, so I am going to stick with that theme, which was my number three pick as well. I've already previewed it with one of the characters, Virgil. And this is cheating a little bit. The two that I'm taking here are Dante and Beatrice and Dante and Virgil. And the category that I was taking were artists or protagonists who find a muse or are influenced by another artist. And I had Bello and Roth on my list here, along with authors like Shakespeare and Joyce or Borges and Cervantes, and people who, it feels a little different to me than the sidekick relationship or the mutual friendship like we've been talking about. It's a little more one-sided. It's one character or author is more of a taker than a giver. And Beatrice, of course, inspired two of Dante's greatest works. He saw her when they were young teenagers. And the funny thing about this relationship is it's not like they were lovers or anything like that. He basically just saw her on the streets and thought she was beautiful and never forgot her after that. They weren't, I think they maybe had some intersection in some social circles later, but it was really just almost like someone might see a photograph or a painting or something is for all the contact they had. But that was enough for Dante. He wrote La Vita Nuova just about that experience, which is a great book. If you don't have the time to jump into the Divine Comedy, I would recommend picking up La Vita Nuova, which is a book I love. And then, of course, in the Beatrice in the Paradiso, she's essentially the Queen of Heaven, which is an awesome place to be for someone. You know, I wonder when I'm walking down the street if there's some author out there who's catching sight of me and will end up writing placing me in charge of heaven the way Beatrice was. We don't really use muses like that anymore, I guess. But in any case, Dante did, and it's a great literary pairing. And then he also had the relationship with Virgil, which was an author who had come years before, and he recognized him as, he called him the Il Miglior Fabbro, which was something Pound or Eliot used to describe Pound and their relationship. But he was saying, you're the better maker, you're the better poet. But you could see Dante wrestling with this idea. He has to put Virgil in hell because Virgil was born before Christ. And so he couldn't have recognized Jesus and gotten into heaven that way. So he's in hell, but Dante is, you know, makes him the guide, that's his guide through hell. Just in general, the way that Dante uses these other figures, I think of Dante as being kind of a solitary guy, but to have Beatrice and Virgil as his companions in these narratives, I thought made them a worthy pick for a literary duo.
I never knew that he didn't sleep with Beatrice. That's interesting.
Yeah,
because back then you're right. I like the analogy to having a postcard of that person and being inspired, a photo.
Right, And also in this category, I thought of, you know, some other great examples of a single author who was really relied upon a family member or a spouse or someone to, you know, make sure that they had room to write or that their genius was something that could be shared with the world by taking care of all of the, I mean, Nabokov and his wife Vera were in that category, and Virginia Woolf and Leonard Woolf and Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas were a good pair, and Emily Dickinson and whoever that guy was that she sent her poems to.
I know who you're talking about.
I thought that songwriting, I mean, I kept coming back to duos in the world of songwriting. I already mentioned Lennon and McCartney, but Jack White and Meg White kind of struck me as being in this category, where Meg White is this figure for Jack White. He's obviously the talented genius, but there's something about Meg White's drumming that always inspired him, and he admired the way it was more primitive and less polished than anything that an actual drummer, you know, a trained drummer would do. And then I thought of the great example of Carly Simon and Warren Beatty, where they were actual lovers, but Warren Beatty's vanity inspired that song, You're So Vain, which, you know, it's probably great to be Warren Beatty, but on the other hand, to have those lines like, you walked into the party like you were walking aboard a yacht, to know that you've inspired art like that. Your scarf, it was apricot. That's going to be in the song forever, Warren.
Yeah, you know, the supportive spouse or partner. My next pick is along those lines, but where the partner or spouse was an equal. But before I get there, I was just reading an interview with Robert Cairo in the Paris Review, and I had no idea that his wife Inna was basically his research assistant. The two of them lived in Texas for 3 years, pouring through Lyndon Johnson's Senate files. So he, and I guess that's part of Cairo's, you know, five-volume take on Johnson, is that he sort of changed the Senate before he changed the presidency.
Right.
So, but yeah, his wife was there. The two of them were writing longhand notes, you know, or notes on index cards. I mean, and I almost feel like she, you know, had she not been his wife, people would probably be paying more attention to her and saying, like, who was this person?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. You know, there's a lot of debate about, I think he lifted a few passages from Zelda's diaries, and Zelda had some ambitions of her own. And it's always been kind of this open debate about, did he stifle her? And was she more of an equal than she's often given credit for? But, or, you know, the flip side is that she was married to genius, and any genius that sort of reflected off him, that she would be forgotten if it weren't for him. And it's an interesting topic and an interesting debate. I didn't know that about Robert Caro's wife. I've read a few of his books, but obviously having not heard of her is pretty telling.
Yeah, I mean, and going back to Zelda, you know, Zelda, and I was reading about this, Zelda kept far more extensive and interesting journals than F. Scott. So F. Scott would often, you know, the two of them would gallivant and have a grand old time the next morning, kind of the details would be fuzzy. But Zelda would sit and write the details, and then F. Scott would go back to her journals and look at that. See, like, oh, where was that, you know, cliff where there was that beautiful party and the view. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people probably, you know, rightly so, don't consider her anywhere near his equal. But she did publish a novel, which I've never read, called Save Me the Waltz, about her relationship with Fitzgerald. And that is on my really long list.
Right.
So, but my pick was Aeneas Nin and Henry Miller. And I kind of was torn between that and Plath and Hughes and Beauvoir and Chartres. I wanted to pick a couple where there was intimacy and sex, if not romance, and literature, because I think in many people's minds, you know, if a couple are both writers and they're involved, you know, the general public romanticizes that and think like, oh my gosh, you know, Paul Auster and Siri, what's her face? Or, you know, they're involved, they live together, they write together, they publish together. And I think that's probably relevant, like 10% of their lives.
Right.
I think the rest of their time, they're like typical writers, being by themselves writing. And so, you know, Nathan and Henry Miller, they kept, I guess, what I want to think of as the literature aspect of their relationship alive by writing these incredible letters for 20 years. They were both newly married when they met, and then they decided that their spouses were you know, big mistakes. And so neither of them, I think Henry Miller got divorced, but Nin wouldn't. You know, she was a Cuban writer. I think religion probably played a part in not wanting to get a divorce. But the two of them had on and off affairs, on and off relationships. They traveled together, you know, and they wrote to each other for 20 years. And I think it's one of these examples that, you know, with the passage of time, this body of letters has become, you know, has grown in stature.
Right.
It's almost to the point where perhaps it dwarfs a little bit of their writing. Because I don't know if Henry Miller, if anyone's really reaching for Henry Miller other than 19-year-old boys. I mean, I'm not sure he even comes up as really relevant anymore.
Yeah, that's interesting. It almost seems like when they are lovers, Beauvoir and Sartre on my list, and a few others come to mind while you were talking, like Paul Bowles and Jane Bowles. And it almost seems like when there is a romantic relationship, especially if the writing kind of fades into time, that the romantic relationship itself still has currency for movies, or, you know, someone to be inspired by the relationship and write a book about that. We're endlessly fascinated, it seems like, with writers from the past and their creativity. And then to think that there was a romantic relationship that was infused with this creative energy from both sides. Abelard and Heloise is another great example of that. That may be where Henry Miller and Anais Nin end up.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it has to be inspiring to be, to have your partner struggling to write and then succeeding. That has to, no doubt. But it also must be kind of infuriating, and the feelings, the complex feelings of competition and, you know, resentment, like, well, I need succor now, and here you are also in, you know, a deep depression and, you know, stewing in the corner. And that's my job, because I'm, you know, so I thought that was somehow to make it work for that long. And I think, you know, if I knew more about Beauvoir and Sartre, I would have put them, I would have picked them instead of Nin and Miller. But I feel like I can't quite do them justice, because I haven't really read either of them other than excerpts.
Okay, so I am going to take a pick and go in the opposite direction and choose two authors who are not lovers, and certainly it is highly unlikely that they ever will be, because they are enemies and they hate one another. This is an unusual pick, but I had to have something from this category of these bête noirs. Jonathan Franzen and Jennifer Weiner. And I don't know if you're familiar with this feud, but it's basically, I'm not much of a fan of Jonathan Franzen's writing. He's sort of one of the current grand poobahs of the literary world, and his books are always accompanied by a lot of fanfare. He comes out with a novel every few years, and it's one of those stop the presses moments for literary magazines, and they put him on the front page and interview him, and everybody reads the book and offers their thoughts and everything. And Jennifer Weiner is really in a different category. She writes genre books, But she's pointed out and has kind of made it her, her position. She's become a focal point of the criticism of the world, of the literary world and literary criticism world, and the whole machinery of books and the publicity machine and the New York Times Book Review and the New Yorker. And what's interesting is it's easy to say, to dismiss her, which I think Jonathan Franzen has done and said, you know, well, my books are serious and hers are not, and that's too bad. And if she's jealous, that's too bad. But she's not really saying that. She's saying something different, where she acknowledges and says, I do, you know, what I do writing these romance novels is different from what he does. But why are there more female reviewers? Why are there more male reviewers than female reviewers of literary fiction? Why does the New York Times cover Jonathan Franzen's book in a way that it doesn't cover a female literary fiction author? And why, this is kind of interesting, why do they cover crime fiction and science fiction and not romance or chick lit or, you know, any of those that are traditionally associated with women? And one of the interesting things about it is women are the vast majority of today's readership. Men are kind of dropping off of the radar as far as reading books. I think it's, I don't know, I've seen statistics where it's 40-60 or 30-70 or something. And so she makes a lot of good points, but I just love that she gets under his skin. She's kind of his, she's always hanging around and always poking she's the needle that punctures his bubble. She seems to bring out him at his highest pomposity, which always makes me laugh. I enjoy their feud more than I enjoy his books, I think. And a lot of this, when it's in literature, a lot of times the characters end up getting together. I was thinking of like Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy, or, you know, they're enemies at first, but then by the end you realize how much they need each other or how much they actually belong together. But then, you know, I also like the pure enemies, like Othello and Iago or Holmes and Moriarty. And sometimes it's nice when a figure just has this obstacle that they can never get rid of.
Well, when they always say the hero is only as good as the enemy, you know, that, not to bring it to film, but the reason that Dark Knight was any good. I mean, let me refer to the graphic novel rather than just, we're talking about books. The only reason that Dark Knight was interesting at that, so great was because of Bane, the enemy. So you sort of need a good enemy, or else you're kind of bored and swatting the villains with one hand. I like Franzen, and I followed his career pretty closely. I think, his nonfiction, I think, is incredible. He wrote a series of essays, How to Be Alone, which was a big hit. And I think, kind of eloquently touches upon things that a lot of people who like literature are struggling with today, which is like, why can't I watch as much television as I want? What do I do with all these books, and how do I make other people interested in books? So he's kind of a nerd which I respect, who wants people to read more and challenge themselves more. He has a very funny essay on William Gaddis and how much he wanted to love him and then ended up kind of hating him. The whole thing with Oprah and now Jennifer, I know where he's going, but I wish he wouldn't get embroiled in these kind of discussions, because I think it's, when I think of the media, it's so easy to be portrayed as a bad guy when you're kind of going up against, the majority. And I think the majority don't really, and not to demean the majority, but the majority of people don't read literary fiction. It's kind of a no-win situation for him to wage this battle. And so it's almost better, you know, just being silent, because no matter how well he crafts his counterargument, it's almost like a counterargument to the wrong, to the bad side.
Yeah, he really doesn't do himself any. He does himself a disservice by this, because he also, you know, it will blur into people's reading of his books. And, you know, the Jennifer Weiner and kind of the Twitterverse, they'll look for the way his female characters are portrayed. And if he were giving more ground in, you know, if he's kind of his own worst enemy, he's always shooting himself in the foot. He'll say things that start out by making you think he's going to agree with the critics and be on the side of, you know, that women's voices should be more heard or something. And then he'll undermine himself with kind of a remark that's comes across as snobbish or something. But then what that will do is it'll give people this laser-like focus on his female characters, and to use that in their battle against Jonathan Franzen. And you're right, if he were just silent, or if he were just could limit his own remarks in his personal feuds about the nature of literature or the nature of the literary world, he would probably not inspire this attack on his female characters.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, there's certain ways to approach it. Like, I love poetry, and I want more people to read poetry. But I'm not going to go around telling people to read poetry, because, you know, poetry, whenever you want to take that, if that's your end goal, you have to befriend the person, find out how they spend their time, what time they go to sleep, and try to work it in. And the way Franzen is, like, well, if you love poetry and you love your life enough, you'll find time for poetry. And it's like, you know, that's going to fall on deaf ears.
Right.
So.
I like the one where he was talking about the narcissistic tendencies of technology. He had an essay about that, and he was saying, like, there's people are so immersed in this technology, they forget what actual love is, and they're not engaged in actual love anymore. And then the example he gave of actual love was his own love for bird watching.
Well, you know, so that's the nerdiness that I like about him. I think, you know, he sets a high bar, but he doesn't have the charisma to, and not to bring in David Foster Wallace. I'm accused by some friends of always bringing in David Foster Wallace into every conversation, but Foster Wallace says, you know, there's time for Shakespeare and there's time for Golden Girls.
Right.
That there's actually a ton of time in your life. And so if you can squeeze it all in, if you try to squeeze it in, you can't. And so you shouldn't make fun of, you know, the latter just because you love Shakespeare. And I feel like that's the, you know, he's on the other side of the spectrum from Franzen. He's like, well, this is an essay about Shakespeare. Why are we discussing, you know, Betty White?
Okay, so you're down to your last pick. What do you have for pick number 5?
All right, I went with Martin Amis and Julian Barnes. You know, talking about literary circles, these guys were friends with Rushdie and Salman Rushdie and Ian McEwan and the poet James Fenton and Christopher Hitchens. And I think at some point, a bunch of them interned at the New Statesman. So they would meet together. They would make fun of their employers, meet together for beers and coffee and talk literature and talk about their aspirations. And they can't help but have inspired each other to, you know, who would publish first, who would become more famous, who would win the Nobel, and, you know, tall goals. And so, but among them, Amis and Barnes became very close. And I think while their writing is quite different, they're both very stylistic writers. And so, you know, Julian Barnes being much more experimental with a book like, you know, The History of the World in 10½ chapters, or Flaubert's Parrot. And Martin Amis focusing really on taking voice and stream of consciousness to the next level. You know, while they were different, they kind of respected each other and saw the other's moves and probably were thinking like, okay, Barnes has done that. What do I want to do? Or Amos wants to try to do this. And so they were very good friends during their friendship, Amos had hired Barnes's wife to be his agent. So they were very good friends until, as the story goes, Amos wanted to have his teeth fixed.
Yes.
And apparently he had not gone to the dentist in like 2 decades or something.
He needed money for this. He needed money to have his teeth fixed. And if you read Amos's early works, there's all kinds of characters who are having nightmares about all their teeth falling out, or like teeth is a big trope in Amos's early works.
Yeah, so he heard through the grapevine that this notorious agent, Andrew Wiley, who had secured Roth quite a big advance, promised Amos that he could get $500,000 for his next novel. So he fired Pat Cavanaugh, Barnes' wife, and Barnes wrote a letter to Amos that ended with the words, fuck off.
Right.
So that was the end of the relationship. And to throw fuel on the fire, Amos, who was a bit of a womanizer, had an affair with Kavanaugh's half-sister, Julie, and that didn't end well. And so that's ended what I think was probably kind of, for a long stretch, is the ideal literary relationship, friendship. You know, when you're a writer, this is the kind of friendship you dream of having.
Right.
And it ended badly.
And they could read each other's works, and they could offer each other criticism, and then they would write reviews of each other's books, I think, and praise each other, and they were allies for a long time. Have they patched things up? Do you know?
No, they didn't.
Still enemies.
I mean, there's still time. There's still time because Pat Cavanaugh passed away. Apparently, there was a dinner party where she and Amos were chatty. That's what I heard before she passed away.
Right.
So that was, but Barnes was not there. So it might be one of those weird, meandering epilogues where Pat's not as mad at Martin as Julian was.
Right. Julian was defending her. Yeah.
And here's a last bit of a little clue to their relationship. Pat Cavanaugh came from a well-to-do family, and when she died, she had an estate of 3.8 million pounds, and she left 5,000 pounds to Amos's son,
right,
who was her godson.
Wow. Right.
And in the British literary world, being as gossipy and petty as they are, were shocked by this.
Right. Well, I wonder if it was for orthodontist bills. That seems like seems like about the right amount. The whole incident with Andrew Wiley was interesting, and I mean his nickname is the Jackal. But if I understand it correctly, he basically was saying everyone else was kind of content with what they were earning because it was based on their sales. But what Wiley was saying is, you're worth more to these publishing houses because you're a prestige name, or they'll overpay for you. You'll be more of a loss leader because they want to, be nominated for the prizes or all of that. And my guess is it probably ended up helping Pat Cavanaugh and Julie and her clients and Julian Barnes and all the others that this became the model. If it's not in place today, it sort of helped a generation of authors live more comfortably and live more, freed them up to write more.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You can look at it. It takes a long view, and that, any time an agent can secure a bigger advance, that has to be good for the writer side of the industry. Yeah. Huh. I never thought of that. I just think of Andrew Wiley as so cutthroat, but maybe he is doing some good in the long term.
Right. Okay, so my fifth pick, I took God and Job from the Book of Job. And I wanted to do something a little bit different for my last pick. And so the category is man and some divinity or some divine figure. I did a whole episode on the Book of Job, so I won't go into it too much. But basically, Job gets hammered by light. God and Satan make this bet where God is saying that, you know, people will love God and not Satan. And Satan says, well, that's easy because you just give them stuff and then they'll like it. So God said, well, I'll take this faithful member of my tribe and impose on him every hardship imaginable. And even when he does nothing wrong at all to deserve it, and we'll see what will happen. And the question is, will he still love God and believe in God, even when he's been visited by all of these terrible tragedies? And what I love about this book is the whole Judeo-Christian tradition requires faith, that a lot of times it all comes down to, well, you just need to have faith, or these are, you know, God works in mysterious ways, or these are things you cannot know the answer to. And it can feel kind of like a cop-out, that a religion, any religion that's worthy, would have answers to this that would go beyond, well, you just have to trust us on this one. And what I love about the Book of Job is it takes this question head on, and it basically says, you're not worthy to even question this. It's, you know, we get that we're asking you to have faith. That's just the way it's going to have to be. And God, you know, in this great monologue with Job, God says, you know, where were you when I created the world? And the idea, you know, like, obviously I'm going to know things that you don't know. And obviously there are going to be things that are just going to be beyond your understanding, which might not be a satisfying answer, I guess. But when I read the monologue, I can go with it. And what I like best of all is just that the Old Testament is saying, we hear you, that this is a question you're going to have, which is, how can you be expected to take all of this on faith? And it puts it into this wonderful story. The other example of this that I kind of wanted to choose was Arjuna and Krishna from the Bhagavad Gita, which I just did in a recent podcast episode, where on the eve of this, there's this long epic book, the Mahabharata, and it has this two warring families, and a lot of it is just adventurous stories. And then on the eve of this epic battle, the prince Arjuna and his chariot driver go out to survey the field, and the prince has this crisis of confidence, and he looks at the two sides, and there's families on both sides, and he says, how can I lead them to slaughter, and how is that consistent with my faith and you know, the focus I need to have on peace and serenity and my own personal development, and how can I lead these troops where brothers are going to be killing brothers, and how is this being detached from the real world the way that I want to be and the way that my faith suggests that I should be? And the chariot driver gives him several arguments for how he's a soldier and he needs to do soldierly things, and that's what he's put on the earth to do, and there's something pure in that, and just focusing on the action and not letting others down, and all of those kinds of arguments. And then the chariot driver reveals himself as the incarnation of God. And it's this fantastic philosophical discussion right in the middle of, you know, you have hundreds of pages of this epic novel, and then there's this section that is a beautiful spiritual discussion, a philosophical discussion. And to think that that's in the middle of what is essentially, like an action movie. I know you were a big fan of Schwarzenegger movies back in the day. I'm not sure if any of his movies have an interlude like that, where you're invited to wrestle with some of the most philosophical questions ever known to man.
It's probably a scene like that in Predator.
So,
well, that pick reminds me of of Falstaff and Hal. You know, just thinking of uneven relationships for a long time. I mean, not that Job gets the upper hand, but you know, for so much of that relationship, Hal is you know, in awe of Falstaff.
Right.
And then he dismisses him, you know, notoriously in Henry V. And it's one of the most incredible scenes in Shakespeare.
I'm glad you mentioned that one. That is a, that's that one. Let's call that pick number 11. That certainly belongs on a list of literary duos. And in this vein of man and divinity, I had God and Moses and God and Noah is another great relationship. God and Jesus would be an interesting one to think about. Of course, I'm assuming that the Bible, I'm reading the Bible as literature here, of course. Jesus and Judas would be an interesting, or Jesus and Peter, Jesus and Mary, Jesus and everyone, really, is, I mean, that's like the duo. What would it be like to be Jesus or to know Jesus, to be any sort of person who encounters Jesus? You're sort of just asking for a duo there. And then the other example that I thought of was John Milton and Satan, where he's writing this this poem, and he's devout and he's doing all of this for the glory of God, and then Satan just runs away with the show.
You're talking about examples of where the villain is more appealing and, you know, more charismatic.
Yeah, exactly. And the Book of Job, I like that it has that bet with God and Satan, where, I wondered as I was thinking about this, where that bet happened. You know, did Satan come visiting in heaven, or did God, you know, was he slumming around in hell? Or I guess if it happened nowadays, they'd just meet in Vegas.
Which is heaven or hell.
So let me recount the list, and then I'll give you a chance to throw in any ones that were hard for you to leave out or any final thoughts. So your picks were Hemingway and Fitzgerald, Elena and Lila from the Elena Ferrante Neapolitan novels, Philip Roth and Saul Bellow, Anais Nin and Henry Miller, and Martin Amis and Julian Barnes. I see a lot of 20th century authors on that list, Mike. My list was Captain Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin, Dr. Johnson and Boswell, the biographer, Dante and Beatrice / Dante and Virgil, Jonathan Franzen and Jennifer Weiner, and God and Job. So who are the toughest ones for you to leave off?
I wanted to work in Jane Austen characters like Elizabeth and Jane Pennett.
Yes.
I just felt like if anyone has done the contrast complementary character, it's Jane Austen. I think she's incredible at that.
Yeah.
It's so rewarding as a reader to see like a friendship developed in an interesting way. And I think that's why a lot of people just keep going back to Jane Austen.
Yes, very true. That is the perfect way of describing it. And you think of them almost like parts of a Swiss watch or something, the way they can fit together and the way they ultimately, you know, it's like a puzzle or some puzzle pieces or something where they just clink together and snug up, and each one fits each other in a perfect way. And a whole book can be revolve around just different puzzle pieces and the way they interact with one another.
How about you? Let's go through your list.
Okay. So a few that I wanted to include, Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot were a couple. And then a few that were a little more, off the board, Calvin and Hobbes, I think is a great, a great literary duo. I've read some interesting things recently by interviews with Bill Watterson, where he talks about the two of them, and that's a fascinating relationship to me. And Nick and Nora Charles, I like the idea of a married couple that is in love with each other, and it's not just strife, but that they're working together. Those are the Thin Man from the Thin Man movies and books. Keats and Shelley was a tough one. Romeo and Juliet were on my list. Falstaff and Hal, you mentioned. Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell had a really interesting relationship. And I had a a special note here to take another look at Frog and Toad, which I I didn't get into, but I think for some of our younger listeners, that might be the literary duo that is most prominent in their minds.
You know, I was just talking to my daughter about this moment in Frog and Toad, and I think it's one of the most amazing literary moments. It's where, I forget which one is the curmudgeonly anal one. I think it's probably Toad. So they make a list of things to do that day,
yes.
And the wind takes the list and blows it away, and they don't chase after the list because Toad points out that the list did not say chase after the list. Which I love the fact kids like that.
It is great.
Yeah.
Frog and Toad are great. And there's moments in there that's genuinely moving, you know, the two of them.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's end it there. And I want to thank you again for joining me, the president of the Literature Supporters Club, Mike. Thanks again for being on The History of Literature.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's going to do it for our episode on the greatest literary duos of all time. I'm Jack Wilson. You can find more at jackwilson.com, jackwilson.com, or send me an email at jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.